Picture this. A recording studio somewhere far, far away.
The Merry White House Experience! Thank you very much, thank you. I feel I have to say that with England playing Yugoslavia in 2 weeks' time that I do really hate Bobby Robson. I really think it's about time that Bobby Robson took some lessons in management technique from Frank Warren. And now, Punt and Dennis, ladies and gentlemen.
Tonight, we probe into a story which was first revealed exclusively by the Merry White House Experience last year. A story which, like Noel Edmonds, refuses simply to go away. For years it has festered, but now it looks like the finger of investigation is about to enter the nostril of corruption and pull out the bogey of scandal. Tonight, we investigate the Stalker Affair. As we stated last year, this complex story rests on the circumstances surrounding Mr. Ron Stalker, the Manchester police chief who was sent to Northern Surrey to investigate whether there had been a shoot-to-kill policy by the RAC.
In 1985, news came from Northern Surrey about various incidents involving the Provisional AA, who it seemed were stepping up their campaign against people who refused their free membership offer. Even turning to violence.
Could you arrange a little accident for Mr. Simpson's Vauxhall Nova?
No, but I know a man who can.
After a particularly vicious leafleting, the RAC decided on drastic action to combat what they called the most ruthless breakdown recovery service in the world. It was alleged that RAC patrols were given secret instructions to drop their expensive advertising and instead to shoot all members of the AA on sight.
It was this allegation which Mr. Skywalker was sent to investigate. However, a few months after beginning his probe, he was suddenly suspended from duty on the grounds that he was, quote, half bald and had a name that rhymed with porker.
The Home Office agreed that these were reasonable grounds to discharge him from the force. Mr. Chalker claims to have been smeared with his own discharge. But he denies ever having edited a Sunday newspaper.
The whole affair and cover-up calls into question the British legal system and its abuse. Tonight on The Law Experience, we look at the police and crime.
The police were founded in Victorian times by Sir Robert Peel, hence their affectionate nickname, Pig Filth. If you want to join the police, the selection process is tough and standards are high. You need GCSEs or equivalent in 5 subjects, including creative writing, which is a useful subject when it comes to taking statements. A foreign language is also useful here, as it will help you with translation. For example, a phrase like,
I was at home with my wife at the time.
Might translate as,
I done it, it was me, you got me banged to rights and no mistake.
Once you're accepted into the police, training proper can begin, starting with the most vital areas.
Squad! Patronise the motorist!
Hello, L.M. Prost.
Where's the fire? Squad! By the right! Ask the bleeding obvious question!
Is this your vehicle, sir?
Policemen always say this as part of their clever psychological training. It's designed to catch you out.
Could I have your name, please, sir?
Simon Mad Dog Crazy Ape Shit Axe Murderer Chop Chop Bin Liner Jackson. Ah, I mean John Brown. Damn. Suss me out.
In Britain, too, the friendly village bobby is now a stereotype figure, inflexible and usually not very intelligent. This is plainly based on fact. If the police are so clever, why do they always need someone else to help them with their inquiries? If you do fall foul of the law, you'll be confronted with lawyers. Lawyers speak a language of their own, a language incomprehensible to laymen. For example, when they say,
you are hereby and herein under charge that you did with malice of forethought, willfully and with intent to commit a felonious act in contravention of the act herein under stated, contravene sections 3.1 and 4.7 subsection 2 of the 1981 amendment to the 1949 act pertaining to the sale, disposal or dissemination by whatsoever means of substances deemed or stated to be of detrimental physiological and psychological effects on the mind or body.
What they mean is,
hello, Mr. Noriega. And now,
Now, the religious experience. Now, to begin with, I should explain that I myself am not a religious man. Although there is one of the Old Testament commandments that I do live my life by very stringently, and that is I never, ever covet my neighbour's oxen. And he's got a bloody nice one as well. Now, religion has always thrived on suffering, and so it is probably through vested interests that in the modern age it continues to propagate the bulk of it. Iran, Ulster, Azerbaijan, and of course, Highway. Now, the problem with religion now is that its tone simply doesn't fit in the modern world. I mean, in biblical times, how did they have ordinary conversations? How did they have parties?
Oh, hello there. I'd like you to meet Ezekiel.
Oh, hello.
Son of Jeremiah, who begat Joseph out of the land of Ezra, who begat Gabriel, he of the loincloth of goatskin. Yeah. Who begat Solomon, who once put superglue up his bum for a dare. You should have been there. It was so funny.
To read the Bible, one has to hear a large, heroic, stentorian voice. Although it was actually written by diminutive clerical types, much given to petty elaboration and digression.
In the beginning, which by the way, was sometime after the first series of the Deuteronomy, God created the heavens and the earth, although who is responsible for my mother-in-law, I wouldn't like to say. And the Lord God formed man out of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Now here I must register a complaint. As you know, one of my nostrils is much bigger than the other. So what happened? You know, did he run out of breath? Or did he... Oh, dear. And now, let there be Barbara Dixon.
In the modern age, to be a Christian basically means following the path of self-sacrifice, especially as regards fashion. They all seem to be part of a popular campaign called I'm Looking Crap for Jesus. Many Christians consider themselves to have been born again. Perhaps this is why they always have wet and greasy hair, pink skin, and after ringing your bell at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning to ask you what you think are the real reasons for all the trouble in today's world, no teeth.
The big problem with Christians is that they're always smiling, and that particular kindly forgiving, oh, my child sort of smile. And there's really very little historical evidence to suggest that that's how Jesus himself would have behaved.
Well, Nazarene, knowest thou that I seek to pardon you? Speak now in thine own defence.
Oh, now, hey, Podchers. It's all right. Look, here's a leaflet. We meet on Thursdays at Jeff's house. And, hey, I tell you what, why don't we both sing a little song about it? Oh, the sun is shining. The birds are singing.
Christians always believe that once they've seen the light, the rest of their lives are a carefully plotted destiny by God. But have they never noticed that all the famous ones are crap people? Cliff Richard, Robert Runcie, and lastly and completely off the crapometer, Alvin Stardust. A man who held the microphone in such a way as to demonstrate very clearly how much he had overused his right wrist. We take you now to the moment at which Alvin Stardust saw the light.
I want you just...
Alvin Stardust.
I am the Lord your God. Throw off your one-spangled glove and follow me.
Oh, my Lord, have you great plans in store for me? Shall I lead the people into the promised land? Am I to be the new Messiah?
No, I want someone to present Supersonic.
Now, I myself am Jewish, so people often ask me what a Jew like me does over Christmas. But actually, I'm from one of those Jewish families that do celebrate Christmas. In fact, we don't just celebrate it. Christmas is the one day of the year when we really get to Christian it up. I mean, we don't just have a turkey, right? We have a great big pork pig. Uncircumcised. We have Christmas crackers with anti-Semitic jokes in them. The rabbi comes around, we say, hello, Father O'Farrell.
Yeah, the least offensive religion is, it seems, Buddhism. Now, our own understanding of Buddhism comes almost entirely from the 70s TV programme Kung Fu. And this is perhaps why when Robert Runcie visited the Dalai Lama in 1981, he beat him up.
Seek not to know the answers, but to understand the questions.
Yes, Master. The question I particularly want to understand is, why can't I use oven gloves when I take the casserole out?
The meditative state Buddhists want to achieve is the ability to hear the sound of one hand clapping. They call it nirvana. We call it Michael Barrymore's Saturday Night Out. Thank you very much.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience.
Aren't other people's dads weird? Don't you think?
No, they're all right when they're young, sort of in their 20s and 30s. But when they get past 40, they start doing the most ridiculous things, like growing their nasal hair into silly moustaches and becoming members of Parliament. I don't actually think middle-aged men should be allowed to be in positions of power. They're far too immature. I mean, how can we expect them to control affairs of state when they can't control what's happening behind their Y-fronts? I mean, Ron Brown, father of two, member of Parliament. I can't believe he's allowed out of the house on his own. What a pillock. Ron Brown, the Michael Foot of politics. I mean, female politicians don't behave like that, do they? I mean, they can't afford to. They'd never get away with it. Ransack a woman's flat. Examine her underwear. There'd be a public outcry. She'd never be allowed back in the House of Fraser, let alone the House of Commons. They'd love it, though. The gutter press would love to have a woman making a scandal in public. You know, a woman MP crying on the House of Commons or something. They'd love it. It'd be irresistible. A mixture of sex, politics and women's complaints. Because that's what they'd put it down to, isn't it? Premenstrual tension. Yeah, just so that they could use the headline, PMT, MP, boobs.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience.
As you may have noticed over the last year or so, it is now actually illegal for any radio or TV programme not to have a business and financial news section. So in order to rectify this, we now have to present the financial experience, the Mary Whitehouse Experience business news slot.
The day's top stories. United Amalgamated bid for Consolidated Incorporated. Incorporated United in leveraged buyout struggle and Amalgamated Consolidated offer a second rights issue ahead of half-year profit announcement. Later on, we'll be asking, who gives a toss? But now, the financial roundup. What happened in the market today?
Well, in the market today, I got some dodgy cassettes for $1.99 each. The sound quality is a bit crap, but they were cheap. Now, after a day of hectic trading in London, New York and Tokyo, the pound dropped 4 points against the dollar, the yen dropped 2 points against the mark, and the French franc dropped 3 set points against Becker before going on to take the match. Sterling performed well against a basket of currencies, though it did badly against a basket of groceries and was frankly stuffed by a basket of scampi. Argument still continues over whether Britain should join the European monetary snake, some pundits preferring the European financial lizard or the world economic frog. The 100 All Ordinaries Index peaked soon after 10 a.m, suggesting inadequate foreplay. Although brokers at several top city firms were predicting that this afternoon the market would hit a 3-year high owing to a combination of renewed investment strategies and some good stuff just in from Bolivia. Top shares, British Gas rose 3 points, TSB dropped 2 points, while Telecom gained 1 point after a home draw with Wolverhampton Wanderers. The Financial Times top 100 remained largely unchanged, with Unilever up, Plessy down, the Stone Roses straight in at number 5.
And now, because it's the financial news slot, it's time for some irritating big deal music.
In Hong Kong, the Hang Seng Index dropped 14 points. On the Paris Bourse, shares rose slightly. In New York, the Dow Jones dropped 3 points, while in Hemel Hempstead, there was 4p off frozen peas at Tesco's.
Now a look at today's markets in detail. Shares rose on opening after trading figures were announced, but slipped back mid-morning after money supply figures were released, before rising slowly before lunch on a rumour that it might rain later. After lunch, shares fell sharply after Harold fell off a ladder in Neighbours.
Well, later in the programme, we'll be discussing you and your money and asking how can you get a guaranteed overdraft. The answer, of course, is spend more money than you've got in your account. We'll also be asking, what does all this obscure financial rubbish actually mean? We'll be talking to a man who actually understands the intricacies of the economic world. We'll also be talking to John Major. Good night.
Now it's time for the Punchline Experience. Before the show, the studio audience were asked to come up with a witty answer to the following joke. I think the Queen should abdicate in favour of Prince Charles because... And round them all up and the best one will win a prize. I think the Queen should abdicate in favour of Prince Charles because it's time Buckingham Palace was razed to the ground and a tinted glass monstrosity erected in its place. And that's from Wimpy Engineering. It would be a good idea, Prince Charles. He cares about unemployed builders and the work of the ATS. Miss A.M. Wyatt, a regular watcher of John Craven's News Round, I think. Because he's been unemployed for 40 years and it's either this or a restart course. From Tom Hampton. The Sun would have to explain what abdicate meant to ex-readers. And that's from Danny. Bit of politics from Danny. Oh, I like it. Anyway. I'm not going to tell you because you wouldn't read it out anyway. Nelson, I got out early Mandela. So that was what the big campaign was about, really. You can't abdicate and eat it. That's from Mr. Kipling. I think the Queen should abdicate in favour of Prince Charles because he'd be upset if she abdicated in favour of anyone else. I think that's the winner. That was from P. Stapleton. Thank you very much.
This.
The ambulance dispute is now in its 19th week, and ambulance workers look set now to go for an all-out strike. In the past, the public have been perhaps more aware of the work of the other emergency services, dramatised in such TV series as London's Burning and The Bill. Now, however, the public have been made more aware of the ambulance workers and their demand for parity. Yes, they want their own TV series. Kenneth Clarke has already cast someone to play the part of the heroic ambulance worker who he feels fits precisely all the requirements of the role.
Oh, yeah, I'm an excellent driver. I'm an excellent driver, yeah, excellent.
Now, Mr. Clarke did, of course, say that this is what ambulance workers are, professional drivers, but one can't really claim that ambulance workers ever behaved like this.
Oh, my God, my mother's collapsed. I think she's had a heart attack. Stop, 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 where are you going?
Where to, love?
The nearest hospital, please. Battersea, I think.
Oh, I'm not going south of the river this time of night, love.
But she's turning blue.
Well, as long as she's not turning black, eh? Cheerio.
But the ambulance workers' cause remains immensely popular. They did amass a petition with 4 million signatures on it. Although it did say at the top, Annika Rice should be dead. Norris.
The ambulance petition included a greater variety of names in it than anything else I can think of, except, of course, Ken Dodd's receipt book.
Meanwhile, the law is that certain workers are simply not allowed to strike. The army, the police, and, of course, the miners. And the government continues pissing away money on things like the royal family, and what use would they be in an emergency?
Hello?
Hello, is that Buckingham Palace? I've been stabbed by my wife.
Well, I'm afraid you had it coming, Mark. Hello?
Hello, Your Majesty. There's been a major pile-up on the A11. Can you get here right away?
Don't worry. One's on, one's with.
And as the Royal Ambulance drives up the Mall, pulled as it is by 6 regimental horses, making its way slowly through the crowds on the first leg of its journey towards the Hanger Lane Gyratory, where 600 people are presently rumoured to be bleeding to death. And oh, she stopped to get out and go on walkabout. How absolutely marvellous. My brother was in that pile-up, but I don't care.
However, one person who definitely should be an ambulance driver is Margaret Thatcher. After all, it isn't possible to be quicker than her in getting to the scene of a major disaster.
And now the angry thoughts jotted down upon returning from a 3-hour traffic jam last Saturday experience.
Number one, why have all crap drivers been to Alton Towers?
It's true. Every single person who drove too slow, drove too fast, cut me up, overtook me on the inside, all of them, without exception, had a "We've been to Alton Towers" sticker in their car. It must be a side effect of going on the corkscrew that, subsequently, you don't feel you're really travelling unless you're in danger of ruining your trousers. Anyway, it's to be expected, isn't it? Because going to Alton Towers is bad enough, but these people have actually bought the sticker. They've gone into the shop and they've thought that buying a "We've been to Alton Towers" sticker would be a good thing to do. What they don't realise is that everybody else who looks at it thinks to themselves, that doesn't say "We've been to Alton Towers," that says "We are sad."
Number two, what is the point of having a car radio if it only picks up crap?
Now, this is one of life's eternal questions, isn't it? And I must have heard nearly every radio station in Britain during my travels, and they are uniformly bilge. They sound flash, but they fail to deliver the goods.
You're tuned to the big one, BBC Radio.
Daventry.
But for those of you who don't actually listen to local radio, I can only explain how vacuous, incompetent, and nauseating the DJs are by saying that Bruno Brooks is more talented than all of them. He's not alone anyway, because their jingles are always better than they are too.
You're listening to Gary Gary. He's hot, he's sexy, he's pure rock and roll, and he's here.
Hello, welcome back. And I'm... on line four, it's Linda, and Linda has a game of battling top she's trying to sell.
Number three. Why do people write "also available in white" and "clean me" on dirty vans?
Now, this is another mystery, isn't it? And it's so annoying, because when you're driving along, you have to read everything. You could be driving along, and you're just about to solve the meaning of life when, bang, your mind isn't available anymore. It's busy. It's tied up reading and evaluating the proposal, "Touch her my car, I smash her your face." I finally come to the conclusion that of all of these stickers, the funniest ones are the ones that just have the name and address of garages on them. I saw one last week that said, "I'd rather be eating a Domino's pizza." And it was on a Range Rover, and I couldn't help thinking that it was in the wrong place. The only location you could justifiably stick a "I'd rather be eating a Domino's pizza" sticker would be on a coffin. Or perhaps at Pizza Hut. Thank you.
This then is a song about a man with no name, a man with no fear, and a man with no taste. A man called Tracksuit Man. The stranger came from out of town. He stood there silhouetted neath the moon. Ah, he was a hard-ass honcho in a crim clean poncho. He lit a fag and he entered the saloon. To Islington on a Friday night, to a crowded bar under neon light, he came. A guy stepped up into the light. His hair was short, his shorts were tight, and everyone was wearing just the same. He said, "Hey dude, we don't want your kind here." That stranger stood and shouted loud and clear. He said, "I'm Tracksuit Man, famous for my quick retorts. Tracksuit Man, and you look like a prat in your cycling shorts. Tracksuit Man, you think you all look pretty cool. Tracksuit Man, give me a tracksuit top and a red cagoule." Here we go. Another night, another bar, he stood and watched them getting in the mood. He was a crazy critter in a V-neck sweater. He knew the time had come to make his move. The music blared, the speakers jumped to a 12-inch styly remix mega beat. The stranger thought he'd try and mingle. He asked for an old Rolf Harris single. A bouncer threw him out into the street. He walked back in and gave that crowd a fright with the only decent lyrics heard that night. He said, "I'm Tracksuit Man, this music hasn't got a tune. Tracksuit Man, was it written by a duck in an afternoon? Tracksuit Man, this ain't the night spot I would choose. Tracksuit Man, I'd rather spend the evening with Emlyn Hughes."
I can reach it, please, baby.
The townsfolk stood there open mouthed. You could tell that they was itching for a fight. It was the kind of scene nobody likes. The posse took their mountain bikes and chased that stranger off into the night. By dawn next day, the mob was back and everyone was silent to a man. What happened? Well, nobody knew. But day by day, his legend grew, because he wore a tracksuit, but he never ran. So next time you're at some terribly fashionable party north of the river and everybody's popping ecstasy and pretending they can see even though they're wearing sunglasses and it's 2:30 in the bloody morning and everybody's freezing because they're wearing those sort of tight black skimpy vests in the middle of sodding February and Gavin in the corner starts going on about the latest Japanese subtitle film he's seen in the metro and suddenly some god-awful hip-hop scratcher rapid acid funkadelic record by somebody called LL Cool DJ Food Processor begins to play. You might just hear a voice behind you say, "I'm Tracksuit Man, and we're all a bunch of trendy kids. Tracksuit man. My tracksuit's crap, but at least it fits. Tracksuit man. A man like me is your only hope. Tracksuit man. Cause if this is alternative comedy, I'm the Pope. See you next week. Hey, hey.
This week has seen the start of the Commonwealth Games in Auckland. Now, the Commonwealth Games, for anyone who doesn't know, is a handicap. 200 years ago, Britain goes into all these other countries, smashes them up, gives the whole population VD, subjects them to 200 years of starvation on malnutrition, and then we see if we can beat them at athletics. And so now, we're going to stage our own alternative Commonwealth Games here in the Parish Studios. Firstly, the opening ceremony. As you may have seen on TV, the games in Auckland were opened by Prince Edward, although apparently he thought he was watching the really useful theatre company's production of Ippy Tombi. For 20 minutes, 300 Maori tribesmen danced and chanted in front of him, and in case anyone was confused, here is a translation of their ancient ritual chants.
Ooh. Who's the baldy in the suit? Edward. What's it like to have no job?
Obviously, we couldn't get Edward, so instead I'm going to choose the most unemployable-looking member of the audience, you, sir. Right, we're going to have a fanfare. What's your name, sir?
Steve.
Steve, right. Okay, Prince Steve. And then, as regally as possible, could you declare the first alternative Commonwealth Games open?
I do proudly...
Sod off. Prince Ron Brown here. I can't believe it. Okay, I should explain just before we start that our games have been specially designed to be not quite as taxing as the ones in Auckland. So over now to the first event, which is the 100 metres sighing.
On your marks. Get set.
Well, an absolutely marvellous... An absolutely masked woman's 9.9, 9.8, 9.9, 10. Now our last event. Our last event, ladies and gentlemen, the synchronised heckling. Team A over here, we'd like you to heckle this man.
Holy marks. Get set.
Now then. Guys and gals. And what they say about me and children isn't true. Now it sounds like I've been having an orgasm for the last 20 years.
Okay. Oi, Team A are heckling him, all right? And now, Team B, we'd like you to heckle this man.
Now, there's a very witty anecdote about Busby's turkeys last season. Please don't heckle me. I'll have to go back to doing adverts for Nuttall's Mintos.
Right, fantastic. The whole audience has come through to the final, and so now could we have both teams heckling this man.
You Catholic scum! Let up to us! Here's a good one! Three Catholics going to a billing shop! Three Catholics going to a billing shop! No, listen, it's really good!
That's all we have time for this week. Join us next week for another edition of After Dark.
You've been listening to The Mary Whitehouse Experience. It was written and performed by Dave Vanille, Rob Newman, Steve Pants, Q Dennis, Dick Hancock, Donna McPhail and the Tracy Brothers. The sound was by Alec Hale Munro and the producer was Armando Iannucci.